This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome, everybody, to IGN Unfiltered. It is our monthly interview show where we sit down with the best, brightest, most fascinating minds in the games industry. I'm extremely pleased to be joined by the co-founder and chairman of Harmonix Music Systems, Alex Rogopoulos. It's always good to see you, sir.
Yeah, you too. Thanks for having me in.
You have had a very unique career, which I'm eager to talk to you about. I mean, Harmonix itself is such a unique entity within the game space. You know, you guys don't just make... video gamers who happen to make music games. You're musicians who happen to make video games, which I've always thought is the real big distinction between you and other people that make games. So what I wanted to start with is on that music background. Were you always musically inclined as a kid?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I started studying instruments as a young child and studied them for years. Although I just want to quickly hedge that in saying I never got very good at them. You know, even though I took lessons for years and years on a bunch of different instruments, I was always kind of a hack. And, and actually the frustration I felt with never being able to really break through and get great at an instrument was part of what, you know, created the motivation to do what we do.
Interesting. So the seed was planted very early.
Yes.
And you were smart enough to capitalize on it later. But, I mean, and clearly you must have been, that alone indicates you're a bright guy who, if you could take that forward, but you ended up at MIT. So was that always your dream, being from the Boston area? Was MIT always sort of one of the big goals?
Well, it was, I think, in large part because my father went to MIT. He was a chemical engineer there, and he very much began indoctrinating me at a young age, you know, that's where I was going to go
to college.
No pressure. Yeah. So that was kind of understood from the beginning.
And then in college, I believe, is that where you met your fellow Harmonix co-founder, Eran Egosi?
That's right. We met as undergrads in some music theory classes, but then we ended up as office mates in graduate school at the MIT Media Lab. And the two of us shared a passion for this mission, and we both decided to start Harmonix when we graduated.
Which, again, it's like, let me back up for a second. So before you meet him, but before you guys start Harmonix, what did you want to do with your life? You get the pressure from dad on getting to MIT. Maybe you should go into engineering too. But what did young Alex Rogopoulos want to do before video games came around?
Well, I always loved music as a kid, starting very young, and then also loved computers. Started programming when I was, I don't know, 6th or 7th grade. And also loved video games as a kid. I think my dad brought home a Magnavox Odyssey system when I was 3 years old or two. Although it's funny, I wasn't thinking about games at all when we started Harmonix. We'll come back to that. But definitely computers and music were, you know, my two greatest interests as a kid. When I went to MIT, actually, I went there thinking I was going to be a programmer. I entered in computer science, but really after a year or so at MIT, I realized that, like, everyone else there in computer science was better at it than I was. I thought, okay, maybe this isn't what I should be trying to do professionally. So I switched, eventually found my way to majoring in music at MIT, which is a strange thing to major in at MIT. There aren't many music majors there, but it's an amazing place to study music, actually, because when you're studying music at MIT, you're also studying you know, calculus and physics and chemistry and material science and special relativity and like all of the,
you know, okay. Almost a break at that point.
It is. And so it's, and you get to, while studying music, you get to meet incredible other people from other disciplines that lead to the kind of, you know, brainstorming that, you know, led to harmonics, actually.
Wow. So your first game, when you and Iran get together, it's called The Axe, which let you use a PC joystick to do guitar solos.
Yeah, so that was the first thing we ever did. It was kind of an outgrowth of the work we were doing as grad students together at the Media Lab. And it was not a game, actually. It was just a creative tool. And, you know, we were... when we started Harmonix, as I mentioned, we weren't thinking about video games at all. We were just thinking of this problem we wanted to solve, which was how to help people who are not musicians feel what it feels like to play music. Because, you know, playing music, it is really one of life's greatest pleasures. It is profoundly joyful to make music. And most people try to learn an instrument, and almost all of them quit because it's so damned hard. And then they spend their whole lives, like, wishing that they could.
What if,
right? And so we just wanted to invent new ways to for people to feel what it feels like to make music. And so our first product, the Axe, was our first attempt at that. It was a way for you to improvise guitar solos or pianos, really any instrumental solos through a joystick, where you would make the melodies rise and fall or the rhythms grow more and less intense, or, you know, control the music in different ways with different buttons and things like that. And it was a absolute failure. No one bought it for lots of reasons.
So just commercially, but it did what you wanted it to do?
Sort of. In fact, it was a bit, we were a bit blinded by it. It had this problem, which is that it made an incredible demo. And everyone who played it sort of like laughed and got really into it. And this is amazing. How does this even work? You know, it was a little bit magical because the machine was composing music and you were manipulating it with a high degree of, you know, control. Yeah. In real time, and it made a really cool demo. And because of how positively everyone reacted to the demo, we became convinced that it was worthy of being a product. And we were, you know, kids at this point, so we were really clueless about what it took to make something commercially successful. And the point is, though, that people had their 15 minutes of fun with it, and then they were like, okay, well, now what do I do with it? They moved on, right? And that's, you can't make a product out of something that only entertains people for 15 minutes,
right.
Except in maybe like theme park contexts or things like that. But we were so young and naive about it that it took us a long time. It took us years, really, to fully appreciate the fact that that basic play paradigm that we had been pursuing was not sufficient to build a business around.
Do you still have a copy of it around? You ever fire it up and look at it from time to time?
I do still have a copy sitting on my shelf, but I never even attempt to fire it up. It's more there as like a constant sort of reminder to
know your roots.
To be humble.
Yeah.
Like just always, like I just try to keep like this whole complete track record of failures in constant in constant display, so that you know you never forget.
Well, after that was a product called Cam Jam, if I have this correct, which let you do guitar solos using body controls via a webcam attached to your computer. Now, that sounds, first of all, like a precursor to both Guitar Hero and Dance Central in a crazy way.
And Fantasia as well.
And Fantasia. Yeah. And then was that also used in Disney theme parks as well?
Almost. So we went through this period, you know, as I just mentioned, where we were beginning to appreciate that the kind of experience we had created was great for sort of short-term
15-minute
experiences, great for theme parks. And so we did do a project for Disney, which was installed in Epcot Center. Maybe it still is. It was there for quite a long time. It was just gesturally controlling music. But instead of a joystick, there were infrared sensors tracking your hands.
Yeah.
I think it was called What If Music Were in the Air, or it was the exhibit or something like that. So we did that, and then Cam Jam was a product that used a camera to track your motion, and you could control music in various ways. And it was kind of our first experience experimentation with motion control of music. Again, neither of those products went anywhere at all.
Well, I mean, how do you hook up with Disney to get... Does somebody who bought Cam Jam, are they a Disney? How does that connection happen?
Yeah, I don't think we ever even shipped Cam Jam as a commercial product. That was just a demo that we built. And I think, you know, we went to a trade show that was focused on the theme park industry. And we were showing off this demo that we had made, and I think someone from Disney saw it and liked it.
Interesting.
And that's how
did you ever go down to Epcot to see it?
Yeah, several times. Yeah.
That's cool. I would feel like I made it at that point.
That was pretty fun. Well, yeah, it's easy to say that, although, you know, you still had bills to pay, and we were struggling to pay them. So
then you move forward. Harmonix starts to evolve into more of a video game developer, Frequency and Amplitude. Come along.
Yeah, I mean, and that was after a total right turn for us as a studio. I mean, something happened to trigger that. I mean, we had been struggling for years to make the interactive music thing work, but then something happened, which is that rhythm games appeared in Japan.
Yeah.
You know, DDR, of course, but also Beatmania, Parappa, you know, which was really the kind of light bulb moment for us when I was playing Parappa for the first time, and you know, I was just like grinning from ear to ear playing that game. And you know, I think at that point we realized, all right, video games is how we can do what we're trying to do, but in a way, well, first of all, where you have these this incentive structure for long-term engagement, and second of all, where there's a business, an actual business model, you know, to pay the bills. And so we at that point began hiring a bunch of video game developer talent to try to build out our skill set in that area and start prototyping our first games.
So we can as a Guitar Hero Rock Band fan of what you guys do, it's fair to trace the sort of inspiration for all of it back to Parappa?
I think so, yeah.
Certainly,
I mean, to some degree, Beatmania also, and, you know, some of the early Konami games, but definitely, you know, Parappa was transformative for us.
I'm going to move the questioning into now the gaming section of your career. And that's, Karaoke Revolution, big hit for you guys. Was that sort of the first time where you really felt like you were on solid footing as a company, or?
Well, it's hard to say. So, you know, the first games that you mentioned that we made were Frequency and then its sequel, Amplitude, that we made for Sony. And those games, you know, that was pretty painful for us, those games, because we thought we had started to break through as a business.
Right.
We had a deal with Sony. They were a big, mighty publisher.
Sure.
There was television advertising and, mass market distribution of the games. And we thought, and those games were critical darlings. They got great reviews. The people who played them loved them. And we thought, oh, this is it. This is our moment. We're finally going to have an actual business. And people will finally play the games that we're making. And neither of them was commercially successful. I mean, they sold a little bit, but they were not profitable businesses. And I think one of the hard lessons for us at that point was to realize that making a game that was fun to play once you tried it was actually not enough. That we really had to, because when we explained those games to people, no one understood them at all. They looked at a screenshot, they looked at a description, and everyone just, they're just like eyes glazed over. And I think we realized that we had to start thinking more deeply about the wrapper around the game. What is the fantasy? Like, who are you asking the player to be? What is the fantasy that they're stepping into? Or what is the mental model of the, you know, what is the wrapping paper that you're trying to lure them into the experience with, right? And so when Konami came to us and said, hey, would you guys like to make a karaoke game for us, which became Karaoke Revolution, for the first time we started thinking about how to package the game. And Karaoke Revolution was moderately successful. I mean, we did, I think, 5 titles in that series for Konami. So it paid the bills for years, and, you know, they sold enough to keep making them, and that was great. But they weren't, like, big hits or anything like that. So back to your question, like, did we finally feel like we were, you know, on solid footing as a business? Sort of, but we were living hand to mouth for that whole period, Frequency, Amplitude, and all the Karaoke Revolution titles, plus one non-music game that we did for Sony, the iToy anti-grav game we did, which was a very emotionally complicated even decision to do that project. You know, we were living hand to mouth, and did not have a hit product, and in fact, you know, we did the iToy game for Sony Anti-Grav, and we had this moment of doubt in 2004, like, when that shipped.
Like a crisis of conscience?
Yeah, absolutely, because that game, it was our, it was not a music game. It was our lowest reviewed game by far. Mm. And it outsold everything else we had ever done by far. And there was a moment in, you know, fall of 2004, after we had shipped that, where we were like looking at that information and thinking to ourselves, we're almost 10 years in at this point. 9 years in, we're still living hand to mouth. We've had critical success, but never commercial success. And then here we make this non-music game that's like kind of mediocre, and yet it blows away the sales of everything else we've done. What the hell are we doing making music games? Like, is this just a fool's errand, this whole thing, our whole reason for being? And it was right at that moment where we were having serious crisis of confidence about whether to continue that a tiny little publisher called Red Octane called us. And you know, they at that point, they made dance mats, like third-party yeah. dance mats for Dance Dance Revolution, and they wanted to become a publisher. And they basically said to us, hey, if we make a guitar peripheral, will you make a guitar game? And that became Guitar Hero. And then, of course, after we shipped Guitar Hero, that's at that point we finally felt like we had a business.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. Yeah. But I'm kind of curious. So, I mean, is your family wondering what the hell you're doing with your life? Are they super supportive? Or because you know you're saying you're talking about how almost 10 years and it's you're just kind of you're getting by but not really succeeding. Did you think about just shutting the whole thing down and trying to figure out something else to do with your life at any point, or
not really? I mean, everyone was so supportive. Family, I mean, our investors, our angel investors who had been supporting us through all those years, were amazing. Meaning, I think most investors would have written us off like long earlier, but we kept getting new rounds of investment and people willing to stay with us while we kind of slowly figured it all out. And yeah, there was that moment around the release of Antigrav where we're like, God, is this what are we doing? You know, but even in that darkest moments, I think that we still felt the same passion about the mission that we felt at the very beginning of the whole thing.
That's great.
So, you know, we're just fortunate that in the end it all, you know, worked out okay.
Did you realize that the irony of what you or how I just heard that whole story? It's exactly like you were actually living out a band fantasy. You were the cool indie band who a bunch of people loved but never broke through with success. And then you're like one pop song broke through and had success, and you questioned your entire sort of musical integrity. It's like there was I don't know, maybe I'm crazy, but that seems fitting that it's
yeah,
just
no,
exactly that same arc.
Very much that model, yeah.
So, had you guys seen or were you aware of guitar freaks out of Japan before going into Guitar Hero?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, that was, and I think, you know, Red Octane, when they approached us and said, hey, would you guys make a guitar game? That was very much, you know, everyone was aware of that. And I think the assessment was, okay, well, that's a great source of inspiration, but there are so many aspects of that product that make it not suitable for a Western market in terms of the music that's in it, the visual aesthetics, the, you know, and some game design choices, et cetera. So on the one hand, we were aware of it and thought it was really cool, actually, and it was a great sort of point of inspiration. On the other hand, you know, we kind of wanted to throw away everything, you know, it's everything and start from a blank slate.
Do you go find it and play it, or do you just want to not even, like, you want to sort of stay away from it and just have your own sort of idea of how you wanted to tackle a guitar game?
Yeah, well, I mean, we had all played Guitar Freaks in the arcades in Tokyo, so we knew the game, but when we were working on Guitar Hero, we weren't actually actively playing it because I think to a large degree, we didn't want choices that they had made to, you know, complicate or pollute our thinking about it.
Yeah, it makes sense. So in the beginning of Guitar Hero, you guys could pretty much only get cover songs. Was that sort of a financial thing, like just because the masters would have cost more, or was it just because nobody knew who you were, really, and the
both.
Labels weren't going to hand over
definitely
the real
both.
Stuff?
I mean, it's at least twice as expensive to get the original masters. So there's the financial factor. I mean, and this was a tiny indie project. I mean, we didn't have the budget to go after the original masters, and even if we did, frankly, like no one had heard of us, and recording artists and the labels, you know, understandably are protective of original masters. They don't want to just license it to anything. You know, there's kind of brand associations and attachments that go along with that. So Really, no one would give us the time of day at that point. It's funny, you know, with frequency and amplitude, we actually had original masters in those games because the, Sony was our publisher, and Sony can get things done.
Yeah.
Yes, and Sony was great at that. But when it was a tiny indie project, it was just not feasible.
You guys found some, like, the covers that are in the original game, and Guitar Hero 2 as well, they're pretty good. Like,
yeah.
How are there any, do you have any sort of interesting stories from either finding those musicians to do that stuff, or?
Well, it was all in one studio on the West Coast, this great group called Wave Group that we found. I forgot how we found them, maybe through Sony, I can't remember, but a fantastic group of musicians who just really threw themselves into that with whole heart and did fantastic covers for us, yeah.
Do you remember who was sort of the first major artist that you remember really getting on board with Guitar Hero, saying, you know, I believe in that, like, take the master, I totally believe in what you're doing? Or maybe, I don't know if that didn't come till Rock Band. I mean, you had some originals, but do you remember that first artist of really...
I don't really remember the first artist, because I think a lot of them kind of came together at the same moment. But it was when, you know, after Guitar Hero 1 happened and we were working on Guitar Hero 2, during that year, you know, Red Octane got acquired by Activision and we got acquired by Viacom, by MTV Networks. And so when we started working on Rock Band and putting some stakes in the ground about the aspects of Rock Band that... We thought we're going to be critical and move the genre forward. One of them was getting original masters, and so at that point we had MTV Networks helping us go out to get that music, and it's a little easy. I mean, between the commercial success of the earlier titles and the buzz around that, and then having more budgets, you know, it was a lot easier to go get the material at that point. So
Guitar Hero exploded. Of course, was there a moment in your life where you realized, like, oh, this is huge, and we did it?
There was a very specific moment. It wasn't huge yet, but it was winter. I think it was like February-ish of 2006. So at that point, it was a few months after Guitar Hero 1 had been released. And Guitar Hero 1 was not like a big hit out of the gate, right? Like, our tiny publisher, Red Octane, like, they didn't have budgets for marketing. They didn't have budgets to manufacture tons of inventory. So it was not selling big yet, but there was a moment that winter, a few months after it shipped, where, you know, YouTube was kind of a new thing at that point, ish, newish, and I just typed Guitar Hero into YouTube, and what I saw was literally hundreds of videos that people had made of themselves playing the game and posted, and I had like a kind of goosebumps moment, you know, where I realized something cultural was happening with the game.
Was there... When the whole thing, I mean, the Rock Band comes out, and did you feel like when Rock Band hits, was that the end point for the studio? Like, was that sort of, did Rock Band achieve everything the studio sort of was about and stood for?
Well, let's see. So, gosh, big question. In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. The ways in which I would say yes, it did, is that this vision for a kind of big budget, multiplayer music performance simulation with multiple instruments and original masters, and it's being marketed by MTV, and we're a major distribution, and it's, you know, it's like it was like a fully realized version of a vision that had existed for more than a decade,
right,
in some form, you know, being brought to market with trumpets, and it was, so it definitely felt like a kind of pinnacle in that regard of something we had been striving for a very long time. However, it didn't feel that way. It didn't feel like a victory. It actually, in some ways, felt like the game was beginning. And there was a lot of tension at that point for a couple of reasons. First of all, it was not proven yet that people would spend like $200 for a video game.
Right.
You know, that we were like,
full
God,
band kit, yeah.
Full band kit. We were like, what the hell are we thinking, right? Like, are people really going to spend this much money for a game?
And you had to convince retailers, too, to take that stock.
A giant box. So there was that. And furthermore, you know, Guitar Hero was now owned by Activision. Activision is very good at what they do. Guitar Hero 3, which launched right around the same time as Rock Band 1, it was a huge franchise at that point, absolutely gargantuan, with like Activision fully behind it at retail and in paid media. And it was like, that's where all of the heat was, you know, the kind of market heat was around Guitar Hero 3. And all of a sudden, you know, Rock Band, which was this big thing for us, right? It was kind of like the indie entry. We're still the underdog, like coming in to fight against Activision. Geez, you know, and we didn't, you know, we really didn't know how that was going to play out, you know. So there was a lot of anxiety and stress. We were also learning how to do hardware for the first time. We had never done that before in our lives. Meanwhile, it's like, okay, in a year, we have to go from knowing nothing about making hardware to like shipping like millions and millions of units into retail. So mostly we just like lost a lot of sleep that year. So it wasn't really a moment of celebration so much as a moment of anxiety, because we were entering a competition against a total juggernaut.
Right. I mean, be honest, did it piss you off that Guitar Hero 3 was built on the back of what you'd made, was the one that took off, and you know, you guys had made this thing, and now it was just sold, and sort of the momentum that you'd started wasn't sort of reaping the benefits of that?
Well, I wouldn't say we were angry about it. It was emotionally complicated because we were... we were attached to the Guitar Hero brand. Like, we had poured our hearts and souls into crafting that brand identity, and we loved it. And so then seeing it, and then for it to become our, you know, our arch nemesis in the marketplace with, you know, versus our new brand was just tough for us, because on the one hand, you know, Rock Band, it's our thing now. Like, we want to be victorious with our new brand, right? But the flip side, it's like we didn't exactly want to beat Guitar Hero. We loved Guitar Hero, right? And so to some degree, you know, we were happy to see both of them thriving and evolving in their own different directions and whatnot. You know, but like, business is business and competition is hard. And so, you know, we had to deal with that.
GH3 and Rock Band had some crossover on songs. Mm-hmm. Is there like a creative and professional pride where you compare your note charts and you're like, ours is better?
Yep.
Because yes, I would do that.
Yes, there is. There is definitely professional pride in the note charting in one domain. Yeah, for sure.
Because that was always the big difference between, I mean, with all due respect to the developers that worked on the games after you left. Like, again, what I said at the top of the interview, you guys are musicians who happen to make video games. Whereas I think when it wasn't you guys making Guitar Hero anymore, it was video game developers making a game about music. And yep. I think to the player, there was almost a difficult thing to pin down there. But when you played it, you could tell.
Yep.
You could tell the difference.
No, and it was. It's one of the things that has been a super high priority for us in making music games, is making sure that those aspects, the musical aspects of gameplay choices, are, you know, thoughtfully attended to. And our audio department, they're all like Berklee College of Music grads and, you know, or other, you know, serious, hardcore, like professional musicians who really take this stuff seriously and do great work.
Would you, from time to time, would you guys throw out like entire note charts and just start over on a song? Because I remember, this is too inside baseball, but I remember there was a version of, I think it was, might have been The Seeker. It was a Who song.
Oh, yeah.
That was, we had the debug kits at our office, and, you know, you guys would upload stuff to there, because it was a developer network.
Yeah.
But then when the song finally came out later, it was a totally different note chart.
Yeah.
So were there times where you guys just, like, you just felt like you'd review something and felt like, oh, this isn't quite working, and redo your approach to how to do a song?
Well, we iterate on that stuff, and so maybe there'll be a first pass on gameplay authoring, on note charting, and then it'll go into our audio QA group, Aqua, we call them, and who are also musicians, and also, you know, have, like, they play the game very well, and as you can imagine, and also have very strong opinions about, you know, charting approach and charting quality, and there can be some back and forth if, like, the first pass is kind of missing something.
So, the meteoric rise and fall of the guitar, you know, Rock Band type, the guitar game genres is well chronicled. Do you blame Activision for it? Do you blame yourselves? Do you think, is it really nobody's fault? Was it just sort of, it was what it was? How do you sort of look back on that 2 to 3 year window where it just was huge and then it seemed like it was pretty much over?
Yeah, well, so complicated subject, of course, but I mean, I think there's a lot of like armchair analysis about it where people just be like, yeah, Activision oversaturated the market and that's why it, you know, collapsed. And, you know, there's probably some truth to that. They were releasing an insane number of titles and, yeah. and that sort of thing. So that's maybe an ingredient, but I think the reality is way more complicated than that. For example, well, one factor is, you know, we were selling the most expensive video games in the market on top of a severe financial recession, right? It's, you know, it was as hard as it might have been to buy a, you know, a $200 video game in holiday of 2007. Imagine that in 2008 or 2009 yeah. when all of a sudden incomes are contracting and yeah. people are, you know, very financially anxious. So that was a factor. I also think that the games did not evolve to provide either sufficient innovation or the right kind of innovation to keep people's interest. I think both Activision and Wii had a misplaced confidence that just by refreshing the music in the game, there would be enough novelty to sustain everyone's interest in yeah. the gameplay. And actually, that has been true for some people. I mean, we still have this dedicated core of players who are like showing up every week to play the game and buying the new songs. And God, I love those people, right? You know, because they've sustained the franchise Absolutely. For, you know, 10 years now. But in terms of that heyday of, you know, whatever, we had like, you know, at one point tens of millions of people playing the game. They had that experience and loved that experience in that window, but then they had had it, and just giving them more music to have an identical experience, I think, was not going to be enough to sustain their interest. There were, frankly, a lot of casual gamers who showed up in kind of peak Wii. You know, there was yeah. that period where, like, a lot of non-gamers were suddenly playing console games because of the Wii brought sure. in this new audience. And a lot of those people have moved on from consoles, and they're now playing, like, tablet and phone games, right? And, you know, I don't think we're going to get those people back on the consoles.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
So in hindsight, what would you have done differently, if anything?
Well, I probably would have accelerated the innovation along some axes that actually we're now very actively engaged in. But, you know, if I could rewind the clock 10 years, I probably would have tried to make progress on some of those axes, you know, several years earlier, actually.
You've now no doubt met a whole lot of famous rock musicians face to face in your life. Do you have any good stories from meeting anybody? Anything crazy? Even like maybe convincing them to be in the game or something like that?
Yeah, so the most interesting, of course, was the Beatles.
Yeah, I was going to get to that, but go right ahead.
Well, so this was a very long courtship. It actually started with George Harrison's son, Danny Harrison, mm-hmm. wonderful chap, musician. He was also a Guitar Hero fan, and you know, we were introduced to him through the MTV music president, a guy named Van Toffler, also a wonderful guy. And he immediately saw the potential of doing a Beatles rock band game, and so we began meeting all of the constituents, which involved like the label side, multiple labels, the publishing, all of the
Yoko and Danny Harrison,
the Apple Corps. And so it was a long courtship process, as it should be, because that's material that you want to take very seriously if you're going to give it a video game treatment. And so there was a moment where we had our first meeting with Paul McCartney in London, and we wanted to show him the gameplay, the Rock Band gameplay, but not just with anything. We wanted to show it to him with Beatles music.
Sure.
So we mocked up. This wasn't Beatles Rock Band at this point. It was just Rock Band, but with some Beatles music that we had kind of hacked into it too, so that I could show him the game with his own music. So we were over there doing a demo. And
what song did you pick?
Taxman, I think, was the one I was playing in that demo. And
were you on drums? Because I know you tend to play in public demonstrations of Rock Band.
Play the drums. Yeah, that's kind of, that's my default go-to, but in this case I was playing the bass because it was his bass part, right? And the funny thing is, so I generally don't get nervous when like meeting celebrities or whatever, but this was a case where this guy, like, I've idolized this band since I was like 7 years old, so I was nervous. And in fact, when I was playing the part for him, I was flubbing it a bit, which is not something I normally do, but I'm like, really? This is when I'm going to not be nailing the part? And he sort of joked, he said, actually, I really needed to understand what happens when you don't play all the notes correctly, so that's, informative. And then he also, afterwards, he did something that was just incredibly warm and generous, which is, he said, look, obviously you're nervous. He says, when I'm nervous, and then he pulls out this kind of bunch of lavender, this fresh cut lavender, and he like pulled out a few sprigs, and he said, here, I cut this from my garden this morning. I keep this with me when I travel through the city so that I don't get stressed out in traffic or other things. You should have some. You just smell it, and it just helps you relax. And that, I just...
What a wonderful human being.
It was. It was like an incredibly warm gesture. And it actually kind of set the tone for the collaboration over the subsequent year or so, where actually all of the members involved, I mean, they were holding us to a very high standard, as they should have, but they were very... They were, with us on that journey, trying to make it great.
Where does Beatles Rock Band rank on your list of career accomplishments?
Well, I mean, it was, if not the high point, certainly on the short list of high points for me personally. I mean, there's exactly one moment in all of the games we've released where I actually like broke down crying while playing our own game, and that was actually in the final cinematic of the in the song "The End,"
yeah.
You know, playing the Beatles, where I was like, "Wow, I feel really proud of what we've done here."
What was the? Could you feel any different energy at the company during the development of that game because of yourself, and I'm sure a lot of other people were even probably more invested in making sure that the Beatles Rock Band was as good as it could be?
Well, it was. I mean, everyone was excited because, Jesus, we're making a Beatles game, right? Like, and that was exciting. But it's also the stakes were high, right? You know, for example, there was this one day where Yoko came to the studio and we were showing her our first cut at making John.
Oh.
Singing and animated in the game. And when we were showing her, you could just see it in her face. She was not happy. It just wasn't good enough. And she, you know, she let us know and on no uncertain terms that it was not good enough. And she was very clear about the ways in which it wasn't. And that was pretty stressful for people. Like, we hadn't really ever, as video game makers, kind of had a client to please in exactly the same way as we did on that project. But the result of us having our feet held to the fire in that way was we ended up making a much better game, I think, than we would have
so
otherwise.
So all your animators are just sweating bullets yeah. in the back of the room?
Yes.
Oh, man.
Yeah, our creative lead on that project is this fellow named Josh Randall. Wonderful guy, really talented guy, and I don't know how he survived it, honestly, having to keep that group of people happy all at the same time.
So after that, in 2010, you and other Harmonix shareholders, of which I assume you are one of the significant mm-hmm. shareholders as a co-founder, you ended up suing Viacom from what I believe, if I read the whole thing correctly, over bonus payments. And you ended up being awarded $300 million. You won. What's that day like when you have to sort of fight for what you've earned as a company, and then you actually win?
Well, God, huge, complicated subject. So first of all, to be clear, the way that all worked is that there were, when we sold the company to Viacom, at that point, we had been funded by angels for years and
yeah.
years. So we were, the large majority of the company was actually owned by our investors at that point. And it was an earn-out deal, meaning that there were contingent payments based upon the financial performance of the business
sure.
over the subsequent years. So it was actually, that lawsuit was not by, the employees, the studio. It was by essentially the head of the investor group.
Right, okay.
And so that was, who was responsible for leading that dispute, although it was a, legitimate dispute over, the terms of the merger that they had acquired us. And so it was pretty anxiety-producing for us for years to have that kind of hanging over our heads. We felt like we had done a deal in good conscience, and we had worked our hardest to make the business successful over the subsequent years. And so to have that, conflict arise after that was certainly not pleasant. But obviously we were happy at the end of the process.
Yeah, because I had Richard Garriott in here too, and he ended up having to sue NCSoft, and he ended up winning. And yeah, he said, and it's just like, It's just like the worst. You don't wish a loss, like having to endure a lawsuit, on anybody. It sounds like it's just one of the most stressful things you can possibly have in your life.
It is incredibly stressful and unpleasant. And I mean, part of it just comes from the fact that in lawsuits, lawyers will say anything, completely unanchored to the truth in any way. You'll see. I mean, like anyone who's been through a lawsuit, has seen this, right? But you'll just see opposing counsel say things, and everyone's jaws will hit the floor that these things are being said. They're so detached from reality, So that's, and I'm not talking about Viacom in this case. We've been through other lawsuits and whatnot, which happens to any business. But after a while, you realize that that's kind of just what the game is about. Just their lawyers saying anything to, make their clients, to get a good result for their clients, and that's just.
Richard Garriott said the exact same thing to me, that it was just telling me about utter fabrications that would happen and how just as someone who's not you're not used to being in a court, it's just completely shocking.
It is.
Oh man. So after that lawsuit's over, did you ever have any thought to just walking away and saying, we won, I'm doing okay. I should just walk away and retire and not do this anymore?
Not really, in large part because, I mean, look, the fact that we were commercially successful and there are financial rewards that come from that, you know, that's great, of course. What's driving us every day isn't really the hope of financial rewards. Like, that's kind of icing on the cake.
Yeah.
Like, it's, like, the most emotional moments for us are always when we ship a game that we're proud of and then watching the world react to that. Is like, that's the real compensation in a lot of ways. Like, seeing people going crazy about a game that we've made that is the best food.
You know? I've told you this before, but I mean, to me, Rock Band is, it's definitely a top five game of all time for me because I've never before and never since had a multiplayer experience like that where there is, you get four people in a room playing that game.
Yeah.
There is an energy
there
in
is,
that room.
Yeah.
That's a Halo or a Call of Duty or a StarCraft, that just these other great multiplayer games, it's just a different thing. When did you know, actually I'll just back up real quick for a second. When did you know that you had some that sort of secret sauce with Rock Band? When did you know it just worked?
Pretty early on, and actually with our, I would say that generally with our best games, you know, pretty early in development. For example, with Guitar Hero 1, when the first prototype was up, it was ugly. It was all programmer art, just like black and white scratches on a screen, low quality audio. And yet, it was already super fun. You just wanted to play again immediately, you know, when a song ended. And I would say I felt something pretty similar in the early prototypes of Rock Band. It was like super hacked in a bunch of ways, but just the fact that you were doing this thing, you were playing this music game, and you were playing it with this group of other people, and your collective survival depended upon everyone to kind of doing their part, and it all meshed together into this kind of unified experience. It just clearly, you know, there was something special there.
Yeah, I remember before Rock Band 1 came out, there was a video that either leaked or got onto YouTube. It was of four people from Harmonix playing Welcome to the Jungle.
Oh, yeah.
And it looked like the most fun thing I'd ever seen, and then it certainly turned out that way.
So now
into the sort of post-Rock Band era, you've got Dance Central.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the idea for Dance Central come from, and how quickly does Microsoft say yes when you're pitching it to them? Or did they come to you?
It was pretty interesting, actually. So this was around, I would say, about 2009, around the time we were releasing the Beatles. It was obvious that the big boom in the band games was kind of coming to a close. I mean, there was still a business there, but it wasn't like the, you know, from the heyday in 2007, 2008, right? So it was clear that we needed to start coming up with some new concepts. You know, what was our next game going to be? And you know, in the same way that we looked at some of the early rhythm games in Japan and thought, like, okay, how can we do that, but you know, but better and in a way that's appropriate for a Western audience and all that. You know, obviously, Dance Dance Revolution had been very successful and continued to be successful. But on some level, it was like a stepping game and not really a dancing game. Like, dancing involves your whole body, and so we thought, okay, how can we make a dancing game like that's better, one that really involves engaging your entire body in the music. And so we started prototyping, and Kinect, we didn't know anything about Kinect at this point. We were just, we were using various kind of off-the-shelf motion controllers, and we had, at this point, manufactured millions of guitars and drums and stuff. We thought maybe we can manufacture like a custom body tracking controller, right? So we were prototyping gameplay, and it was really promising. And then Microsoft booked a meeting with us, I think at GDC, and disclosed to us their plans for Kinect. And we all just looked at each other and like, well, it just so happens we have something that would be perfect for that. And so we, you know, showed them what we were up to with Dance Central, and it was like, it was a very easy partnership to figure out at that point because the, you know, that game and that technology were like made for each other.
Oh, that's awesome. And in fact, on that note, I'm curious, so then we had Dance Central 2, there was another one, but then when Microsoft's launching the Xbox One, fast forward a few years, how on earth do they not call you to have a Dance Central 3 ready to go for launch? Dance Central was arguably the best and probably the best selling outside of the pack-in game Kinect game there was. What were you guys just sort of on other projects and just couldn't do it? Or was there something else going on there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can't speak for Microsoft, obviously, but my guess is that, you know, we had done Dance Central 1, which was our, you know, our biggest seller on Kinect. It had a crazy attach rate, yeah, as you said, to the Kinect. We did Dance Central 2, which improved in a lot of ways, but actually sold less well. Then we actually did a Dance Central 3 for the Xbox 360 and Kinect, which was improved. It was better in a lot of ways than the earlier titles, but also sold less well than the previous two. So there was a tapering sales curve,
yeah,
that was not so dissimilar from what we had seen with the with the Rock Band and Guitar Hero sales taper as well. And so, you know, I'm just guessing at this point, but if I'm Microsoft, I'm thinking like, well, you know, it's not clear that that title would have the power to really move the dial again,
right,
for this. Plus, you know, my guess is that normally with a new console launch, they're maybe focused on wooing the core gamers in the beginning, and, you know, the Dance Central was never for the core gamers.
Right,
so,
right.
This is all just speculation in any case.
Makes sense. By the time Fantasia Music Evolved releases, Kinect had more or less already been abandoned,
yeah,
by Microsoft at that point. Did you guys have any idea that you know, that situation with Kinect was coming, and do you have any regrets about that project, or is it just sort of there's nothing you can do about it and you move forward?
Well, I would say we had some sense that it could be coming, simply because, you know, Microsoft was in a very difficult, you know, market share battle with Sony, who was selling the PS4 at a substantially lower price point. And a big chunk of the cost structure on the Xbox One was clearly the Kinect, which, yeah, is an expensive piece of technology in every box. And the early adopters of the expensive new consoles, the core gamers, never really cared about Kinect. So there was a lot of belly aching among the core gamer community about the expensive, you know, the price point of the Xbox One because of this piece of technology that they didn't care about. So we saw all of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just a force of gravity. And I think ultimately, you know, I don't begrudge Microsoft. They made a decision that was probably the right decision for the console, which was to unbundle it. Now, of course, for us, making a title that presumed 100% attach, yeah, I mean, we basically greenlit that project presuming, you know, 100% attach of the Kinect to the Xbox One platform. That was a tough blow, and kind of sealed the fate of that title in a lot of ways, I think. But, you know, that's business. You said, like, would we do anything differently? I mean, maybe we wouldn't have committed to a project of that size, you know, obviously, if we had known that that's the way things were going to break.
Yeah. So I'm curious, I've been wanting to ask you this ever since Rock Band 4 was announced and came out, because the timing of not only the release, but the announcements of Activision bringing Guitar Hero back with Guitar Hero Live and you guys bringing Rock Band back with Rock Band 4 were so close. They practically happened simultaneously. So did you guys start development and through record industry people, Activision gets word and says, "Oh crap, we better get this going too." Or is it the opposite? Does Activision start? Do you hear rumblings through contacts, and you guys go, "Uh-oh, they're bringing it back. This is our chance." Like, do you have any insight into how that happened?
I think we and they were all looking at the same data, right? So both franchises had devoted fan bases from the prior console generation who, you know, were probably waiting for a comeback of some kind. I don't think either of us wanted to get out there in the first holiday season when the installed base of the new consoles,
right,
is still
so
pretty
low.
Small. So by the, I would say by holiday of 2015, when both of us came back with those franchises, both of us had calculated that there was, you know, a critical mass on the new consoles that would be ready to buy those games. So I think it was really just both of us looking at the same market evolution and making the call to pull the trigger, you know, at the same time.
And you guys pulled off some pretty unprecedented stuff. You carried forward the DLC on the Xbox platform. Did when you first approached Microsoft about that, did they laugh at you, or do they right away go, "Yeah, we can make that work for you"?
Probably somewhere in between those two things. Like, you know, we had the same conversation with Sony as well. And it was a massive massive undertaking because you're talking about thousands and thousands of independent DLC offerings, each one of which needs to be manually submitted, which had been done over a period of about of like 5 years,
right,
by much larger organizations, you know, on both sides, you know, back in the heyday, and you know, so convincing both Microsoft and Sony to do the work that was going to be necessary to reprop all of those offers for the new consoles. It was a tough proposition. It was a big ask to both of them, because it was a lot of work on our side, but also a lot of work on their side.
Yeah, certification, right?
Right, and neither, you know, the game is not as big in this generation nearly as it was in the last generation, so it was like a lot of work for less return for them. So, you know, I would say that we, you know, we're pretty grateful to both Microsoft and Sony for doing the work to make that possible. And it was just a huge priority for us because we thought it was going to be critical to our players who had invested. In some cases, we have whales who have spent thousands and thousands of dollars on their DLC catalogs on the last generation. To start over on this generation and say, hey, guess what, everybody? You're going to have to, you know, rebuy all the DLC you want. It might have been more lucrative for us to do that, but it just felt wrong. And
sure,
ultimately, we just felt like we had to bite the bullet, do the work, and do what was right for the fan base. So,
yeah, that you mentioning whales, that remind, are there people out there? Is there a person or multiple people who actually own every single song?
A few, yep. We have some folks who have thousands of pieces of DLC, and some who literally have every piece of content we have ever released.
And I mean, I guess now with on the new consoles with external hard drives, you can fit it all. But the biggest, there was on the 360, there were 250 gig drives. Is that even enough to hold everything? Or
I don't know.
Do you have any idea?
No, I think 250s would not be enough. I think they were already using external drives even on the last generation. It's crazy.
Man, so I'm probably going to look real dumb asking this, but I'm going to. I have you here. I'm just going to take a shot anyway. I heard a rumor a long, long time ago that from a person I trust, but that I know that you're already like laughing, but that there was talk of bringing Rock Band back, but that you guys were talking to Activision about like uniting the families and say, well, let's, you know, this whole thing crashed, let's just come back as one thing together. Was there any truth to that at all?
Oh, possibly some. I mean, the Activision people we have known for a long time. You know, we developed Guitar Hero 2, which was published
right,
by Activision
by them, yeah,
after the acquisition. So we know lots of people there. We were through lawsuits with them. We were, when Rock Band and Guitar Hero were competing, you know, we know lots of folks there. So we've kicked around all manners of ideas over the years, and so maybe that was one manifestation of that. So, you know, it's like we've been fierce competitors at various points. We may work together on projects in the future. You know, who knows?
Yeah. Any chance that over the next year? I mean, so we're a nice way into Rock Band 4 now. Is there still a chance we might see some big name artists pop up? I mean, we saw the Who, the big Who pack pop up well into the Rock Band life cycle. But you know, the Metallicas, the Springsteens, some of these sort of bigger artists that we either never had or it's been forever. Is there still a shot that that some of these big boys might come around to Rock Band one day?
Yeah, I mean, we hope to continue to invest in Rock Band as a living platform for a long time. We're still releasing weekly DLC,
yep,
at this point, and we hope to for a long time. We just added a major new feature to the system, the synchronous online multiplayer.
Yes.
And so we hope that it remains a fertile platform for a long time, and we maintain an active dialogue with all the major music companies, a lot of major music managers, like trying to get some of those artists who have been holdouts for a while or who we haven't had in a while. So absolutely, I would say, you know, never say never on some of that stuff. The flip side is, you know, when we were selling whatever, you know, 5-7 million, you know, units a year of the franchise, there was enough cash flow to make it worth their while financially, and not just because it was something that was cool, right?
Yeah.
And when you're dealing with, you know, artists, some of the artists of that stature, like if you can't wave a 7-figure check in front of them, it's hard to get them to even, you know, pay attention, right? So what we get is often we get the bigger artists, you know, who still play ball with us in large part because they like the game and they're
That's
just
cool.
they want to be involved with it. I would also say that we have lots of new stuff in the works that isn't Rock Band, and often with the new projects, either because the budgets are bigger or because it's new, and new things attract, you know, it's shiny objects. It's sometimes easier to get, you know, attract the attention of some of those giant artists.
Who's the biggest artist that you never got or have yet to get that you've always wanted in Rock Band?
Led Zeppelin. I mean, obviously, it's
the like, obvious answer, but still,
yeah, no, the best I mean, I, you know, it's like I love Zeppelin. I like played in a Zeppelin cover band in high school. It's like lots of people would love to see their music in the game. It would be wicked fun to play in the game. We've asked repeatedly.
Did you ever get close? Did you ever get a meeting with Jimmy Page? Or
we've had dialogue with the band. Absolutely, like this, it's you know, I think they've given it serious consideration, but you know, for various reasons, it hasn't been right for him. So.
Oh, that is a shame.
Never say never. You never know with these things.
What do you feel like the future of Rock Band is? I mean, we've got Rock Band VR coming up.
Obviously with the traditional console Rock Band, we're going to keep nurturing it in the obvious ways, I think, primarily with content, but also some, you know, gradual feature evolution. In terms of the big, bold evolution of the franchise, Rock Band VR is our next step. It's a pretty radical departure from what Rock Band has been in the past, and you know, we'll see how that pans out.
So for those that may not be familiar with what it is, because as we record, it's not out yet.
Yeah.
I haven't had a chance to try it. So what's sort of the elevator pitch version? Because I think people think, oh, okay, well, so I'm seeing the Note Highway in VR. What is it, and what makes it cool by being in VR?
Sure. Well, actually, let me answer that by telling you a little bit of the kind of origin story.
Please.
And how we got to where we were. So, you know, when we began talking with Oculus and we had an opportunity to start working on Rock Band in VR, the first thing we did, obviously, was just hook up Rock Band in VR. You know, with the Note Highway.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool. You know, it's you're there in VR. The track is suddenly in 3D. It's like it's all really cool. But the thing that immediately becomes obvious within the first few minutes of playing with it is that, you know, Rock Band gameplay makes you look at one spot
on the
screen. You can't even blink, you know, in the fast passages, 16th notes rolling by. You don't even want to blink. So you're hyper-fixated on this one point in space from the beginning of the music to the end, which is part of what makes Rock Band so kind of hypnotic in a regular console game context. But in VR, that's like that fixation on one point in space is the opposite of what's awesome about VR, you know. In VR, you want to be like in the space.
Yeah.
And looking around and absorbing everything that's great about being in that space. So our approach with Rock Band VR was, on the one hand, to preserve the classic gameplay, because there are people who are just going to want to do that, and it is cool. And in fact, we've taken a slightly different... The gameplay is identical, but we've taken a different approach to the visuals that's kind of tailored for VR. So we've really tried to make the track, the Note Highway, like really beautiful, more so in a way than we've ever had a chance to do in the past. But the really exciting thing, I think, about Rock Band VR is that we invented completely new guitar gameplay to play to the strengths and the virtues of VR. And what we really want players to be able to do is be in the space, be on stage, look at these throngs of adoring fans gazing up into their eyes, you know, be able to look at all their band members playing their instruments, gaze up at the searing lights, like have the live rock performance experience to be there.
Which is what your company is all about.
Yes. And so doing that required inventing new guitar gameplay that doesn't require you to look at a track all the time. So the starting point for that was just building a guitar performance simulation system where, you know, you hold down various chord configurations on the guitar, you start strumming, and you start producing music. And with quite a high degree of control over the music that's coming out by choices that you make about how you're strumming and fingering and whatnot.
Cool.
So there's no gameplay there yet. It's just an awesome kind of guitar performance simulator that feels really good. From there, once we had that, we built gameplay that doesn't require you to gaze at an interface all the time. Essentially, there are lots of different things that we will score you for. We will, say, at the top of every section, cue you on specific chord configurations you should be holding, so you kind of need to check in to pay attention to that every once in a while. That's pretty cool. We also score you for changing your hand position in synchrony with the actual harmony and the music changing, what we call chord following. doesn't require you to look at an interface because you can hear it in the music once you've played a few times. We also score you for different kinds of pattern building. So there's like a Tony Hawk-style trick book that recognizes certain pattern changes.
That's cool.
You can choose any combination of chords you want to construct those patterns, so there's a lot of creative agency in the music making, but there are these objectives of specific patterns that we'll recognize and score you for. And then there's a whole like overdrive system as well layered on top of that. So there are all these different ways of earning score in the game that makes it a more like SSX or Tony Hawk-style score acquisition system on top of this performative guitar experience that feels really amazing.
And you slap one of the touch controllers onto the neck of your guitar, is that correct?
Yeah. The head of your guitar, there's a clip that actually ships with the touch controllers, and you can use any of your, you know, a current Rock Band guitar, and so you take the guitar right into the game with you. You know, put on your
That's
riff,
cool.
Look down, and the guitar is there with you in the space. It's really awesome for immersion, actually.
So I want to pivot for a second here because I have to ask you. I didn't actually know that you were in Broken Age until I played the game, and I was like, I know that voice. Who it? Now I know who it is. You backed Double Fine's Broken Age at a high level to no doubt to support your friends at Double Fine, and that enabled you got to be a voice in the game. You actually had a pretty substantial role. How fun was that?
It was tremendously fun. I had never done anything like that. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Double Fine and Tim, and so I was very happy just to be supportive of the game. But that actually making that cameo as a character was super fun. I've never done voice acting of any kind or any acting of any kind, right? So super amateur. But they had a voice director, this woman named Chris Brown, who's fantastically talented.
Yeah, you see her a lot on the documentary.
Yes, who handheld me through the whole thing and made it a really entertaining experience.
That's so great. I've heard that Harmonix has a support system in place at the company that allows your employees to go off on tour with their bands. Is that accurate?
Sort of. I mean, essentially, we very much want our employees to have, you know, rich lives outside of their day jobs, right? And so for our visual artists, that might be their visual art career. But often for many of our people, whether it's obviously our audio team or even their engineers and artists, many of the artists and engineers and everything else in the company are also in bands. And so if they want to take some time off to go live in that world for a while, normally we're pretty supportive of it. You know, we need to make sure that it works with our production schedules and whatnot. But yeah, we want our people to be developing as musicians and be inspired as musicians as well as everything else.
That's great. That's amazing. I love that. In fact, like many Harmonix employees, you're in a band.
You're
in a band. It's if I have it correct, it's with your brother Chris.
Yeah.
And the band is called Newfane.
That is correct.
So what kind of music do you guys play and what instrument do you play?
I play drums in that band, and it is with my brother Chris, who actually works with me at Harmonix. He's our chief operating officer, and Greg LaPiccolo, who has worked at Harmonix for years on bass, and a guy named Greg Huang, who's our singer-songwriter. It's alt rock. You know, it's not a serious endeavor. It's a bunch of middle-aged guys just like playing rock for fun, you know, but it's all original songs. Check us out on newfane.bandcamp.com.
That's awesome.
We have a lot of fun with it.
What does music do for you, playing music in Newfane? What does it do for you creatively and emotionally?
Well, just going back to some of the comments I made earlier on, there is something just mysteriously and profoundly joyful about playing music, about your body moving in synchrony with sound, about making sound, about doing it with a group of other people, about having having your heartstrings tugged by this kind of this mysterious abstract sound wave somehow, like unlike every other art form, right? It's like writing, film, painting, it's all representational in some way. But music is this one art form that is completely abstract and yet has this power to move us emotionally on this like limbic level. It's crazy. And that's certainly true when you're just listening to music as a listener, as a consumer of it. But it is doubly true when you are actively involved in making music. And you know, I said it's we play in a band. It's not a serious endeavor for us, but it is still this just magically joyful experience to play music. So I hope I'm doing it to the day I die.
That's awesome. Last question I have for you. I'm curious, you know, you've brought Rock Band back. You've got these other projects, Rock Band VR, Drop Mix. What's the future of harmonics? Because the company has such a unique skill set that, you know, what kind of projects do you see the company taking on over the next 5 years?
Well, I would say that there is a kind of a guiding theme for us right now as we try to invent new kinds of music gameplay. And that relates to what I'll call musical agency. Meaning, if you look at the history of music games and rhythm action games, those games have mostly been games where you are prescribed a set of tasks and you are judged based on your ability to perform those tasks, right? There's no creative agency on the part of the player. Like in Rock Band, there is a recording and your job is to faithfully render that recording through your performance, right? And if there's any binding theme in our projects going forward right now, I would say it's that we are trying to introduce ways for people to express themselves and make creative choices through the gameplay that will make the gameplay more interesting, that will make it more interesting and deeper as a musical experience. So, for example, in Rock Band VR, through this new gameplay, the player has the opportunity to make every single performance his or her own. Every performance is different and new and makes it kind of mysterious as a musical performance, not just as a gameplay experience. In this karaoke game we're making for Gear VR, Sing Space, you know, conventionally karaoke games have just judged you based upon your ability to sing and pitch. That's fine, but in Sing Space, we're very much using an audience of other users to judge you based upon how entertaining you are. So if you're entertaining as a singer, you know, your pitch accuracy maybe is not so important, like how expressive and interesting are you as a singer. In Drop Mix, every performance is different because combining these ingredients gets you these surprising results that sometimes are okay, and then occasionally you get these amazing combinations that, and you've created something that didn't exist before that sounds incredible.
Yeah, which so, you can save those.
Then you can save those and you can share them. And so this kind of creative agency over music is a theme that I think you will see a lot of in Harmonix games over years to come.
So Harmonix's work is not yet done.
Oh, no.
That's what you're telling me.
Not in the least.
Well, Alex, thank you so much. This was an absolute pleasure. Alex Rogopoulos, the chairman and co-founder of Harmonix Music Systems, makers of some of the games that have given me some of the best memories ever in gaming. For more from the very best, brightest, and most fascinating minds in the games industry, be sure to check back for new episodes of Unfiltered every week. New segments every week, new episodes every month, right here on IGN.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.